Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gap Fest for Thursday, December 26th, the Stay Seated Bro edition. Merry Christmas, everyone, says the only Jew on this podcast. I'm Hannah Rosen, recording from the DC studio, and I am joined in New York by June Thomas from Slate. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hello.
So you have a cold, June.
I do, but you know, I'm struggling through just for the sake of the XX Gab Fest.
And for Christmas merriment, of course.
Of course.
Christmas merriment, yes. I hope there are no big family fights out there, anything like that.
No,
not yet. This is our first ever call-in show, meaning that you, our listeners, have gamely called and sent us in questions to answer, and we're going to do that very shortly. But before we do, we want to announce that we'll be having a live show in D.C. It's a repeat of last year's Valentine's Day show at 6th and I. It's not posted yet on the 6th and I site, but we will tell you when it is, and we hope you all come. And then before we really, really start, I want to run a letter that we got. I got several letters, and especially to my email, about our male friendship show by men who were wounded or intrigued or something like that. My own husband was kind of irritated because people were tweeting at him that he didn't have any friends. So I felt a little bad about that. Like, I wasn't really saying that. I was saying, you know, he has friends in a different way than I have friends. But people read that as David doesn't have any friends. So he actually got offers to, you know, go for drinks and stuff like that. Like, I'll be your friend kind of tweets. So I'm going to read from Bob Kahagan, who wrote me an email, and he says, I think there is a gay thing concern with male friends. My close friend and I live 90 minutes apart, so we occasionally meet halfway at McDonald's. We always hug when we meet and depart, and we occasionally make some comment about, I guess everybody here thinks we're gay. Both of us are very liberal and older, but there's still that lingering attitude in our past about what we were taught about being gay. I thought that was fairly honest, yeah. You know, complicated letter.
We also got an interesting note from a trans guy, a female-to-male transsexual, who said that he was very interested in the way that his friendships had differed according to whether people had first known him as a woman and had a friendship that way and now as a guy, and that some guys will say things that they would only say with women or women. It was just a very interesting perspective.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting.
I'm looking forward to the super fantastic trans memoir now that, you know, trans is sort of mainstreamized in the open, that somebody writes a memoir about their different experiences living as a guy, living as a girl. Mm-hmm. It's really, really interesting. Like, how do friends treat you differently? How does your workplace treat you differently? You know, it's like an old Eddie Murphy skit, but lived out in real life. Okay, so let's hear from our first caller.
I'm from upstate New York. I was calling for the XX Gab Fest to ask what they think about the new GM CEO, Mary Barra, and the discussion of whether or not she's a car guy. And also, if you all have any car guy credentials or any good car or driving stories. Thanks.
All right, so let's start by talking about Mary Barra before we tell our car driving stories, because I actually have some good ones. So what did you guys think of Mary Barra when you read about her? She seems like a lovable, admirable gal. No?
Yeah, she seems boring in the best way, right? Like, mm-hmm. she's not sort of attention-grabbing. She rose up the ranks. It's like a good old-fashioned, like, success story.
Yeah, I was. It's funny, when I first saw that she had been there for 33 years and I looked at her age, I thought, what? So she started at 18? Did she start in the secretarial pool, which is a very revealing kind of assumption that I made? In fact, she has a BA in electrical engineering and she was an intern at 18. Yeah, she seems like she's really done everything right. You know, again, another red flag that went up was I saw her previous job before she was named a CEO was head of HR, which is a typical woman department. You know, Microsoft, that's where you have the woman exec. But it really does seem like she has this amazing background. However, I also read some stories that suggested that she's kind of been given a poison chalice, that the job has been changed pretty significantly by some other tweaks that they made, like now that although she's CEO, for the first time she's not going to be chairman of the board. There's also been a president named. So it's like the job is being divided, or the sort of leadership is being divided, which is, generally speaking, never a good thing, because then, you know, the lines of accountability can be confused. So that did give me some cause for concern.
I didn't know. I mean, I read all those stories and the commentator didn't seem to link it back to her being a woman. In other words, there wasn't the suggestion that they had added the president and the other higher up job because she was a woman and they didn't trust her. Maybe we were supposed to read that between the lines, but that's not how it was presented. A lot of it was presented in terms of business restructuring and, you know, here's what a lot of companies are starting to do because they want to divide the power. So I actually couldn't tell if that was a sign of, you know, we don't actually really trust you, or if that's just, you know, them trying out a new strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. That was I certainly didn't draw that conclusion. But at the same time, it does feel like it's not setting her up for a fantastic success. I mean, the company has done well, which of course it should, since it essentially got to have a fresh start and kind of clean out all its bad stuff. But my only concern was, if or when she does an amazing job, will she get all the credit that she deserves? And I guess there's no way of knowing. That's all terribly speculative.
Yeah. Jess Gross, our sometime GabFest colleague, wrote a good piece on Elle.com about how, for once, a company is not bringing in a woman CEO at a troubled time. It's called the glass cliff, I believe. when you only hire a woman in sort of dire circumstances, you know, because women
Carly Fiorina.
Yeah, exactly. Women are thought to be good at sort of cleaning up messes, but maybe not sort of charging forward and being dynamic, perhaps, is the perception. But it seems like in this circumstance, she is not being brought in that way.
I want to spin out the best case scenario, which is that if this is a purely practical move, and it's practical on several levels. One is the knowing the consumer move. Libby Copeland wrote a great story for us in Slate about how bungling car companies have been about selling to women, how behind they are, how sort of sexist and ill-informed. So she quotes this very funny consultant named Clotaire Rapaille, some French guy, who says that women care about car interiors because they're programmed to create life inside their wombs. yeah. Thanks, Clotaire. And then, you know, and then she runs a car ad that says, you know, wear a Mustang to match your lipstick. You know, this sense that women only care about cars because of their color or their exterior or something like that, which is woefully behind because, in fact, more women are now driving than men and more are first-time car buyers than men, and young women just have more money. And so there's this idea that the car companies are way behind the curve in how they market and deal with women. And she does talk about that. So that's one sense in which it's a smart, practical move. The second sense is, if you think about all the manufacturing companies, they're seen as part of the dinosaur economy, right? Mm-hmm. Like shipbuilding, car manufacturing. I remember this was a problem. I was in Korea doing some reporting for my book, and Hyundai was trying to sell its cars out in the world, like just, you know, sell them in France and in America. And part of the problem was that they would show up to these export meetings and it would be like a wall of men in black suits. And it just made them seem like ancient, right? Mm-hmm. Like they couldn't possibly design a kind of hip car that would sell to a young French market, say. So the idea is, if you put a woman forward, it at least makes you seem like you're not part of the dinosaur economy. It's like a smart move in that sense. Like, look, we're fresh, new, young, hip. We can have a woman too. So those are two ways in which I thought it was a good, interesting move. And it would be great if she succeeded for that reason.
For sure. I'm rooting for her.
So do you guys have any good car stories?
Yeah. So I have never actually owned a car. I don't really drive in New York, but I love driving. But when I was in high school, all of my older siblings had the use of a 1984 Ford station wagon. 1984 happens to be the year that I was born. And the car died before I did. So by the time I was old enough to be in possession of the keys, I did not have a car. And my friends were spoiled enough that some of them were getting cars for, you know, their birthdays or whatever. And I kept asking my parents and they kept laughing and like, are you kidding? Like, so I think it was for my, it would have been my 17th birthday or 16th birthday, whatever birthday. They gave me a gift and I opened it and it was like a little model of a pink Cadillac. And my mom was like, look, we got you a car. And then she started cracking up hysterically. And I never got a car in high school, but I still have that little pink Cadillac and it sits on a bookshelf in my apartment.
Aww. Did it match your lipstick?
God, I hope not. It's really powder pink.
Hannah, I don't know how to drive. I've never even had a driving lesson.
Really?
No.
Why?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I've thought of this a lot because now, of course, I live in New York and driving is just nobody wants to do that anyway. And you don't need to. And it's fantastic. But, I've also lived in other cities in the U.S. I lived in Seattle for 15 years, which is a town that, although there are buses, I really wouldn't recommend not driving. But I think it's kind of my last connection to my working class roots because, it's fairly, or certainly was when I was growing up, it was typical that working class people didn't know how to drive. Once when I had a job in London, it didn't matter what people's jobs were. When the company got a vehicle that they wanted some people to drive, it suddenly became clear who was working class and who was middle class because according to who could drive. And so in a way, I mean... that's part of it on a psychological level. The other thing is I have no sense of direction, I mean at all. And I'm just terrified that if I learned to drive, I would, on the first day that I went off in my vehicle, get so hopelessly lost that I would never be seen again.
End up in Indianapolis.
Uh-huh.
But you were part of a carpool in Seattle, which talk about very fondly.
I can't believe you brought up Vanpool. Yes, I was definitely part of Vanpool. And actually, as a non-driver and, as somebody who, it doesn't matter in New York, but in Seattle, I really needed rides a lot of the time. So you do kind of have to ramp up your charmingness. Mm-hmm. And so,
so this is the origin story of June Thomas's charm.
That whole notion that you have to not just sit there like a lump, but, amuse people and entertain people and somehow get them to offer to give you a ride when it's incredibly out of their way and all of that. So, yeah.
So my car stories have a lot of gender essentialism in them. So they're also working class stories. I grew up in New York, but a different New York because I grew up in Queens. And my father's a taxi driver and my brother's a mechanic. And so there was a sense in my family that the boys were the drivers and they knew how to fix the engines and the girls sucked at driving. It was just kind of – nobody said that, but it was just understood that that's how it was. And – so, but I wanted to defy that stereotype. In fact, my mother got into huge numbers of car accidents. She's just a really reckless driver. I actually grew up thinking car accidents were completely normal. Like, of course, doesn't everyone get into a car crash once a year? Because that's what we did, Like, I remember all the succession of cars that my mother crashed and went through. And then I vowed not to fall into that stereotype. Like, I was not going to be the bad driver. I was going to be good like my brother and my father. But in fact, there's evidence that I'm a pretty shitty driver. I completely wrecked our car on the highway last year with five children in it. Five children driving out to West Virginia. And I have no explanation for why. It's like weird. It's like it's faded in the stars for me to prove my brother and my father right, And I wasn't talking on my phone. Like, I really can't explain why I lost control of the car.
Yikes.
And it's happened to me two or three times. So I do feel like there's some I want desperately to have car guy credentials and I just don't.
Now, who taught you to drive? Did your dad, the taxi driver, teach you to drive?
Yes. My dad, the taxi driver, taught me to drive. He took me out once and taught me to drive. And he and my brother, like, loved, as soon as we got back from our little driving lesson, they loved to tell stories about how I had screwed things up. Like, like, we got home and that would be the dinner table conversation. It's like, you know what Hannah did? Actually, they call me Hannah. You know what Hannah did? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's like, just tell the story about how I didn't stop at the stop sign, or I rear-ended some guy, or I don't know how to park. Now, the one thing I do know how to, the one legacy my father left me is I'm a great parallel parker. Like, he taught me the science of parallel parking, and I can do it right every time. Awesome. So, you know, for that, I'm eternally grateful.
I thought you were going to say that he taught you to be a good tipper of taxi drivers.
I am a really good tipper of taxi drivers. I always pay cash. I never pay with a credit card. I mean, having grown up with my father, I know exactly what makes taxi drivers happy. So I do that one right.
Can I just check one thing? Did you say he took me out one time? So, there's always this thing, like, whenever we're dealing with the Rosenplatzes, you know, that you kind of know that, like, what would take you 10 times, they could probably do in one time. But, like, really, you had one lesson, and that was learning.
Oh, no. Did I say that? I did not mean to say that. And the Rosenplatzes and the Rosens are, like, entirely different. You cannot confuse those two. There's, like, the Rosens are just a wholly different breed than the Platzes. They really exist in utterly different universes. But, no, my father took me out many, many times.
Oh, okay.
You know, I don't exactly remember. And I also didn't have a driver's license for many years. Like, he kind of took me out, but I never really bothered to get my driver's license until after college because I didn't really need it.
Right. It seems really hard to learn to drive on the streets of New York.
Yeah,
like,
right?
I went to like a suburban parking lot and drove around a bunch of times before I was ready to go on the suburban back roads. Like, I can't imagine just like going on Broadway like at age 16.
The BQE.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up right on the BQE. Mm. Anyway, okay. So should we move on to our next question?
Let's.
Hi, Double X. This is Holly Mosley calling from Austin, Texas. I'm a huge fan of the show. My question is about violent girls in YA literature and film. Characters like Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games and Triss in the more recent Insurgent series are ones I find both fascinating as well as troubling because of their love for weapons and guns. Triss especially is a big-time gun aficionado. I find them troubling in this age of the Newtown school shooting and an increasing debate over gun control in America. So I'm wondering what you think were the cultural forces that led to the creation of these types of characters and what role you think these characters play in the culture now. Thanks so much. Keep up the good work.
So I would say Tali is right. There are a lot of violent girls around lately, and I love them. I'm really into the violent girls. I think it's fabulous that there are violent girls. The thing that I can't tell is whether in the Hunger Games and in the Divergent, Insurgent, Detergent trio, they are like it's an intentional feminist message or not. That's one thing I have trouble reading in the YA books.
Oh, doesn't it? It seems pretty clearly feminist to me. I've read and loved The Hunger Games. I haven't read any of the other sort of YA girl lit, but it seems, you know, very explicit that, I mean, even just making her the heroine in that way, that just seems like an explicitly feminist act, no?
Well, the interesting thing to me is that I always notice it with Katniss. Like, I often notice that Katniss Everdeen is a classic male hero. She's, you know, I think I've said this before on the podcast, she's unpleasant, she's reluctant, you know, she's a provider for her family, she's the protector. I mean, it's really a lot of classic male traits, whereas PETA has a lot of classic female traits. He's a baker, he's, you know, he's the romantic, he's the one who makes nice with the crowds. I mean, they really, it feels like when you list their characteristics, an explicit reversal of stereotypical male-female traits. On the other hand, my daughter does not notice that at all. Like, she doesn't come to me and say, oh, wow, Mom, like, they really did some gender reversal. You know, she just doesn't think – it's, like, completely normal. She's never said a word to me about Triss, or there's this Tamora Pierce, these Alana books, which she's also read. And she just doesn't experience it as gender scrambling. It seems – she doesn't think about it at all.
And, good.
Yeah, it's really good. I think it's fabulous. And I just wonder if for the grown-ups who wrote these books, you know, if there was an explicit crusade here or what. I just don't know.
I mean, I figure there must be with the gender stuff. But the violence stuff, I mean, is a little a separate issue, right? I mean,
yes.
I feel like with Katniss, which is the only one, I haven't read the other series that Tali referred to, although I've seen them on the cover of Entertainment Weekly because the movies are going to start to come out. But it feels like, you know, Katniss has this amazing skill or series of skills. She's a, you know, which seems, even though it came from her now absent father, is something that's just like innate to her. It's a instinctive skill that she has. And it feels like she is able to kind of instill this revolution by choosing not to be violent. Like in a dog-eat-dog world, she doesn't. She only kills the bad dogs and she doesn't eat them kind of thing. Like she only kills when she absolutely has to. I mean, she protects, I'm forgetting the name of the young character.
The girl.
Yeah,
from,
her sister,
from,
you mean?
No. Well, she does protect her sister.
Oh, Rue.
Rue, exactly, yes.
Yeah. She doesn't have like a bloodlust about her.
Right,
you know, she's not like killing for the sake of killing.
Yeah, she's like a good hunter in a way that she only kills to eat. She doesn't kill for fun, for sport.
And that's a classic hero trait.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's a very American trait, too.
I found The Hunger Games to be upsettingly violent, actually. When I mean, I was really into the books, and then mm-hmm. I would sort of stop and be like, oh, that just happened.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I just don't particularly have a stomach for violence.
Yeah.
But it is pretty dark for something that's aimed at 11-year-old girls or whatever.
I agree. Well, I went to the movie with my girlfriend who hadn't read the book and also is very sensitive to violence, and it was like I traumatized her. I think she just wasn't prepared, and it was just so violent, so scary that it is kind of, when you sit down and really think about how much existential threat there is motivating the book, the whole kind of concept, it's very, very scary.
Here's my question.
Harsh.
Hannah, is your daughter into the violence of it? Because when I see the movies, I just get bored at the violent parts. I'm like, let's go back to the love triangle, which I know is a very stereotypical reaction. But is she into that aspect of it?
She doesn't. She doesn't take it seriously.
Okay.
She's into the action, so she likes the plots and how the plots move along, and she likes the settings. So she's very into the kind of fantasy fiction settings. And you know, in the Divergent books, it's very interesting because Triss is destined for a clan that seems very female. Now I'm forgetting its name. It's abnegation, right? Like that's her family's destined path. You know, they're abnegation, like selfless. They're just supposed to help people. And then she ends up being one of the divergents, meaning she can't be slotted into a path. So that seems very explicitly feminist, right? But my daughter neither reads that as explicitly feminist. And she does, the violence to her is just like, oh, that's just what fantasy fiction is, you know? It's just a part of modern fantasy fiction and the books that kids read.
Are these books like to help kids study for the SATs? Like abnegation, divergent? No, seriously.
Now, what about a movie like Kick-Ass? That was, you know, in the cinematic version of The Violent Girls. Did you?
I didn't
know, Kick-Ass is really violent.
Remind me what Kick-Ass was.
It's like a comic heroine. You know, they're sort of a superheroes, but one of them's a young girl, and I think she's 16 or 13. She's young. She's a teenager in the movie. And at the time it came out a couple of years ago, there was a lot of controversy about having a teenage girl wield weapons in the way that she did. And then there's also Angelina Jolie, although she was more in Salt, but she was more in the mode of Katniss in the sense that she was the reluctant hero, a lot like Katniss. Like she really only wanted to wield her weapons surgically, instrumentally, and for good.
Well, you know, since you just mentioned Salt, it reminds me of The Americans, the great FX show that is about a couple who are actually deep cover Russian agents who are passing as normal, you know, American couple, typical all-American couple. And one of the reasons that they're able to be so successful, because they are an amazingly successful set of spies, is that Keri Russell, who plays the wife, just, you know, is very good at being violent, but also, you know, looks like a sort of nice lady or, you know, a hot woman, depending on whatever it is that she needs people to believe her to be. But, you know, that is something that, you know, again, it's a very typical, very gender essentialist trait that people think that, you know, a woman can disarm people just because she looks so skinny and so vulnerable. And actually she is, you know, a natural-born killer or a very trained killer anyway.
So are we into violent women right now because it's sort of the last taboo to have women be just killing everything in sight? Or are we into it now because it's finally normalized in some way?
The reason this is a tricky question, which Tali brings up, is that it is closely tied to empowerment. It is really hard to separate those things. I have a chapter like that in my book in which I talk about how violence among women has increased. I mean, there's a corollary. It's not just happening in fiction. That, you know, women are publicly displaying more forms of violence, are going to prison in greater numbers, especially young women, but also middle-aged women. And that's also tied to the fact that women are less likely to be victims of domestic abuse and various other things because they kick men out. So it's really hard to kind of separate that line between finding your power and then it tipping over into violence. So I do think it's something our culture is trying to work out. I always think of it as the corollary to how our culture is trying to work out domesticated men, you know, like Up All Night and all these shows about men taking care of kids that have been on TV in the last 2 years. I think of those as the two tropes that we work out. Like, how much can we handle a dominant, aggressive, violent woman? How much can we handle a domesticated man? So it's not that pop culture has a political agenda. It's just that we these questions are swirling in our heads in the culture, and so movies help us work them out.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny because Up All Night and all those other shows like that have been terrible failures. There have been a whole bunch. Every fall, it seems like there's another group of shows about guys who stay at home. They all fail. None of them make it till Christmas. And yet, on the other hand, all these shows about violence, even when they are, you know, when they seem empowering, I mean, The Hunger Games is great on a certain level, and yet it is about violence. And the fact is that violence is very successful, especially on television and movies. I'm not sure about in books, but you know, the highest performing TV shows have a lot of violence. Therefore, people make shows that have a lot of violence. I mean, it's just it's a sad reflection, I think, of a weird you know, aspect of our society. At the same time, like, you know, I sometimes think of, okay, I was trying to work out if the whole Katniss thing was a reflection of the fact that there are all these guns in America. Even if there were no more guns sold tomorrow, there would be so many guns already in America. Maybe it's all about kind of learning how to live with guns, learning how to live with lethal weapons, learning how to kind of control your instincts around them. I don't think
that's so.
That's
so terrifying to
I
think
know.
About.
I don't think that's what's going on, but like, there are some discussions of violence that involve violence that might actually be ultimately geared towards reducing violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Hunger Games is explicitly about a society that has become so inured to violence.
Yes.
and kind of incorporated it into its politics and its daily life that it no longer notices the most absolutely gruesome manifestation of violence.
Right.
I mean, that is part of the story. And so Katniss is in opposition to that because and so are all, you know, the group
yeah.
of insurgents because
yeah.
they think about the, you know, they take it to heart when mm-hmm. one person dies. And so when there is that scene in the first movie where she creates a grave for Rue, that is the emotional high point of the movie because she is taking a death seriously, unlike everybody around her for whom deaths are just markers on a scoreboard.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we move on to our next question?
Let's.
Okay. But before we do, let's welcome back our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. Audible offers over 150,000 audiobooks, as well as almost any chatter available on the internet. If you want to be a smart person like us on this podcast, then you can listen to lots and lots of things on Audible and fill your brain with excellent things, especially over the holidays. For XX listeners who aren't already Audible members, they offer a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX. I can say I, for one, my family is driving up to Vermont, and this is when Audible is our friend. We listen to lots and lots of Audible books on tape, both for children and for grown-ups. The book I'm going to recommend this week is The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman because he has created the female heroine, Lyra, and in that case, very explicitly feminist heroine. I absolutely love those books, and amazingly enough, he reads them himself on the Audible version. So you should listen to that. On the other hand, but you would have to drive like in June fashion, you know, to
like not
to Montana. No, you have to drive much further than Vermont to get through the whole His Dark Materials series is what I'm saying. It's really, really long. So you'd need a really long drive. Like by Vermont, we'd get through a quarter of the first book. Anyway, your membership includes a free subscription to either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, so give it a try today, audiblepodcast.com/XX. Okay, let's listen to our next question.
This is Katie, and I have a question for the XX Call-In Show. I've been a stay-at-home mom for about a year and a half, and when I tell people this, like at parties or whatever, I get a lot of mixed reactions, and I've heard a lot of similar stories from my friends who work in childcare or in the teaching field. And I was wondering, you know, what do you think, even if people pay lip service to the fact that raising and caring for children is very important, why do you think that these jobs are not more prestigious or better paid? And do you think that it has something to do with the fact these are predominantly female career paths?
So I find Katie's question to be very, very painful because she's right. There is a lingering sense in which women's jobs are not as valued, and I wonder if that is connected, despite our cultural notion that, you know, taking care of children is the most important job ever, that we don't believe that at some level.
I think it – yes, I think that is absolutely true. I also think it has something to do with money and the fact that it is work that for eons people have done for free – is just something that in our like consumer capitalistic society, we sort of can't shake the idea that if people do it for free, then why would you pay someone so much to do it? There's just something deeply embedded about that. And my other theory is that maybe it has something to do with, you know, everyone who has a white collar job now, the jobs that are sort of highly valued in our society, sits at a computer all day. Mm. And there is something weird where jobs where you don't sit at a computer, which could be very, very hard and very complicated, generally are not as well paid. And so I wonder if there's also just something along with that, that people think, oh, if you're not sitting at a computer, if you're not crunching numbers, if you're not working in a Word document, you're not really doing hard work, which is actually insane because it's much harder to take care of children than to, like, you know, work on a spreadsheet and, like, refresh BuzzFeed all day.
Did you guys ever listen to Hannah Jaffe Walt's amazing series about disability, about the explosion in disability in America? Anyway, it was fabulous. But at the very end of it, it goes on for sort of an hour. And the very end of it, when she asks a woman, because her the question she's asking is, why is no one working? You know, these people, nobody seems disabled. So why do we have all these, you know, full towns of people in which everybody's on disability? And the woman says, you know, it's because the job I want is a job where you sit down. So that the distinction, class distinction, is defined by whether you sit or stand at your job very explicitly. So it is something about being at a computer. But the other funny thing is that, you know, in this era when we try and encourage men to do more childcare, isn't this a problem? Like, isn't just this a sort of hypocrisy that we need to work out? Like, we can't say we want men to be involved and stay-at-home dads and all that if we, on the other hand, devalue taking care of kids.
I don't know. I mean, I think you're probably overthinking it there. I mean, I think it would be very hard to find someone who would say this is a job that's crazily underpaid, that that if we do pay so little, we are not getting the kind of stimulation and quality and attention that kids deserve at the same time. And also, the way that we indicate respect these days in a profession is to give a lot of money. That's how you decide whether a job is a job that gets a lot of respect. Does it also get a lot of money? At the same time, there are so – I mean, every working mother that I know is able to work because – they're paying someone to look after their kids for a good bit of the day, and they're probably already paying more than they can afford, even people with good jobs. It's very expensive to have people take care of kids, and it should be more expensive, but people couldn't afford it. It's like, you know, we're not paying lip service to the fact that we think that this is an important job, but I'm not sure that it's just possible financially for people to pay more, so they end up kind of becoming hypocrites. But it's maybe better to be a hypocrite than for everybody to give up their careers, because that's another fact. I mean, another part of the question.
Yeah, but that's – you're in the American bind there. Like, the only reason we all do that is because we live atomized lives and we, you know, should have a better child care system. Like,
absolutely.
Nobody – you know, you shouldn't be paying an individual person to watch your children. You should be sending your children to a, you know, lovely daycare center.
Absolutely.
Like they do in many other countries, and that would be much better. I mean, a more complicated question is – not purely the child care question, but the women's professions question. And this is a debate I have out a lot with many of my critics about whether in the economy women choose, you know, are women making rational choices when they choose a job like nursing, which is – or a job that's lesser paid but gives you slightly more control over your time? Or is that an inherent sexist bias in the economy that, you know, what economists used to call the pollution? Like as soon as women enter a job, the job becomes devalued and doesn't pay as well. So, you know, secretary being the first most famous example at the turn of the century, secretaries used to be male figures in the Dickensian era. You know, they were guys who would in fact be the trusted secret keepers of the organization and destined for future leadership. And then as soon as women started going to secretarial school in the 1920s, you get a total reversal of that and the profession becomes devalued as it's associated with women. Teachers are the same thing. Right. Teachers used to be men, now they're women. So the medical profession in
Soviet Russia, you know, it was a job that women did and it wasn't a particularly valued job.
Do you think that's still the case, though? Like, do you think if there were a new industry today that women entered that it would automatically be devalued? Because I can't think of one. I mean, secretary is sort of an older example, right?
Well, I give the example of pharmacy in my book because pharmacy is one that's working in the way of the new economy, sort of like what I said about GM and car companies, that the fact that women are associated with it gives it a kind of cachet, right? Otherwise, it would be automated, right? You could think of pharmacies as being automated. You could have machines dispense. Pharmacists are just people who hand you your pills. But in fact, pharmacy just kind of gave itself the image of first-line medicine. You know, there the pharmacist is smiling at you and explaining to you what's the, you know, result of taking these medications and which ones you should mix. I'm not saying the pharmacist actually does this. I'm just saying this is what the profession's self-image is. And in order to do that successfully, they kind of upped the years you have to go to school and it became much more of a women's profession. And that was its path to success, not failure. So there are ways in which, you know, industries can use women to show that they are, you know, up and coming and modern and whatever.
Right. So that's the trend is going in the right direction, right?
We hope so. We hope the trend is going in the right direction. It's on Mary Barra's shoulders. If she succeeds, then the whole system works.
Yeah. Are we actually having a positive, like, outcome in this question? This seems impossible.
Yes,
on this question?
Exactly.
Well, we kind of got away from the actual question because none of us wanted to grapple.
We were so depressed.
I mean, okay, we'll end on that. The emotional core of the question is the interaction at the party, right?
Yeah.
If you meet a woman, a young woman, who tells you at a party in Brooklyn, D.C., wherever, that she's a stay-at-home mom, what flashes through your head?
That her partner must have a really well-paying job.
Yeah, that's true.
Really?
Yeah. That's true. That's
because
totally
I know
true.
So many people who would love to spend more time with their kids. I mean, you're a mother. I mean, the fact that some people spend like 6 weeks with their kids, I guess 6 months, 3 months, like I think then that they feel awful for several more years. But they kind of have to because their family needs the income. And I think there are so many people who I know would really like to spend more time with their children while they're kids.
Oh, you're so optimistic,
well,
June.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great divide. You know, what have I learned over my 13 years of parenting? There is a great divide between stay-at-home moms and working moms. There is a kind of mutual suspicion. It just exists, you know. But it used to exist much harder in my early days of parenting where each one thought that the other was really harshly judging each other, and maybe they were and maybe they weren't. And I think ultimately what I've learned is that there are stay-at-home moms that I have met over the years who love being stay-at-home moms and they should be stay-at-home moms, you know, and they really sort of they love it. It just seems suited to their personality. And there are many others just because of the cultural message who feel distinctly uncomfortable with it for, you know, 13, 15, 20 years. And I guess you just have to divine which one you are, and you just have to be honest with yourself about that, just like there are working moms who feel uncomfortable about working all the time. Now, you're right, June. Some people just have to work. Yeah. So this really isn't a question. But I think it's just, you know, it's just like anything else. It can be good or bad.
Yeah, and I grew up with a mom who stayed at home. So I actually have a lot of respect for stay-at-home moms. But I do have a moment where I just have a conception of someone who's my age and stays at home with her kids. It's a weird thing where I know that I just feel so strongly that it's important work and my mom is one of the smartest people I know and she did this. But then I have this moment where I'm like, wow, that's so crazy. I can't believe you made that choice, which is, you know, just a gut reaction that I can't get rid of.
And do you think when you have that gut reaction, do you think it's about feminism, like, oh, this person is taking us back, or it's more about the individual person, like, why don't they want to work? You know, why wouldn't they choose to have a fulfilling career?
I guess I think it's more the latter. It just it seems crazy to me that – but I also like my job and feel lucky for having that, and I can see, you know, jobs that would seem a lot less enticing, you know, versus spending time with people you love.
Yeah, sometimes a lot of it has to do with choice. Like sometimes you sniff off of someone, and this is much easier for women to do than men. And in this sense, I guess women are lucky that they're just backing into motherhood because they're a little lost in their careers. You know, it's almost like they have that option. I remember a science researcher saying this to me once, that you reach a point in your scientific career of great uncertainty, and everybody does, you know, where you just kind of sub-making it and you're not sure whether whatever it is you're researching is going to go big or not or get you a good job. And that's a place where women kind of back out and get lost because they do have another option, whereas men don't really have another option. I mean, it's just not quite as socially acceptable for them to back out into childcare. And so it's that, I think, is the crucial moment. Like, did you just drift away and back out, or was it something that you actively chose because you love to stay home with your kids?
Right.
Okay. Next question.
Hi, ladies. My name is Ashley. I am 35. I live in Florida. I'm a full-time mom and worker. And I want to know how you guys relax. Every woman I meet is overwhelmed. We have so much going on. And I just want to know how you mellow out and just kind of deal. I don't know what that looks like for you. Is that yoga? Is that reading? Is that, obviously it's not cleaning for June, but maybe that's taking a hike, not figuratively, but literally. I'm just wondering what you do to kind of balance out. I'm a new mom of 7-month-old. I'm still trying to get this whole doing it all thing under my belt, and I don't know if I'm doing it right because I'm constantly stressed out. I've gotten sick with like some type of cold every single month because of stress, and I feel like I need to learn how to chill. But every woman I meet doesn't know, or seemingly doesn't really know the answer in terms of just kind of how to decompress. And everyone's always bitching about how stressed out they are. So my resolution this year is to mellow out and to find an outlet. And I am just needing some inspiration. So I love your show and thanks for a wonderful year. Bye.
I'm definitely not going first with this relaxed question. I'm not going first. Somebody else has to say.
Look, I feel like such a joke answering this question because I do not have a 7-month-old baby. I feel like somebody who has very little responsibility. I work from home. I do work long hours. I work really hard, but I don't have to make anybody's tea. I don't have to go, you know, run those 35 errands that it seems that people with kids have to spend half their life going from one place, taking the kids. Like, my life just feels so much less stressed. Or rather, there's only one element of stress. There's only work stress, not work stress and kid stress and relationship stress and housing stress and all those things. So I will answer, but I had to give that long preamble. I watch television. That's a surprise, everybody. You know, I was thinking, too, I used to do more arts and crafts. And I actually brought some arts and crafts for people. I brought an arts and crafts for you. I brought one for Chris
Wade. Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Wait, what are they? Tell us.
So I used to make these things, artist training cards. And so it's a very specific size. I can't remember now what it is, maybe 2.5 by 3.5. And then the only rule is that you don't sell them and you sign them and put the date that you make it. So you're supposed to either trade them or give them away.
This is so cool.
And this is one on the theme of raccoon. So it has a drawing of a raccoon and then a little excerpt from the poem Raccoon by Anne Sexton. And it's... So anyway, I used to do that, but I haven't done it in ages. But when I was just thinking about it, I thought, oh, I should do that again.
Wow, this
is so cool.
Lovely. And arts and crafts seems like it works a different part of your brain, which, you know, we don't get to exercise that much.
Yeah, it's challenging in New York. I think the reason I haven't done it much is like space and, you know, mess and all of that. But
yeah, I feel like my answer is somewhat similar to June's in that I am not responsible for anyone but myself, which can be stressful in and of itself. So I have a lot of time to relax. And so I felt like a little bad answering this question. But I do get stressed. Like I'm a high stress person. So so I do yoga sometimes and I drink red wine and I go to the gym. I mean, I don't do anything that interesting to relax. I mean, one thing that I end up doing a lot that I think is actually really counterproductive and I want to stop doing it, but I will just sort of like mindlessly read the internet, you know, because yes. I'll be like at my computer and it seems fun to click these links. But in fact, that is not, I don't think that's doing good things to my brain or relaxing it in any certain way. It's just, I'm at the same machine that creates the stress and I'm, you know, looking at the bright lights and the pixels. So, I mean, I think, you know, anything that sort of gets you away from the stressors is good. I mean, also just like getting a drink with friends, I would say, is if you can swing that, that's probably the most relaxing.
Do you have trouble sleeping, Noreen?
I do on Sunday nights only.
Me too. Oh my God, what's that about?
Sunday night existential dread.
Yes. Yeah. That is so weird.
I run through to-do lists on Sunday nights because all of us, it's all the things that I was going to get done over the weekend and didn't get done. But in general, I don't have trouble sleeping, but just, you know, that one night a week sometimes.
What about you, Hannah Rosen?
Yeah, okay. So here's what I have to say to Ashley. You cannot relax when you have a seventh-month-old. So you really should just take that pressure off yourself. I'm not kidding. Until the baby's 18 months old at the earliest, you cannot relax. Like you just haven't gotten enough sleep. You don't know really what you're doing. It sounds like this. You're new moms. This is your first child. You're going to be stressed out because it's stressful. And I don't know if you have any family around you, but it's just new. So it's stressful merely for being new. So please take the pressure off yourself to relax. It's really not possible. On the other hand, you are tapping into a universal generational issue, which is that women now are overwhelmed and they have a lot to do and they do have trouble relaxing. The statistics bear you out. If you look at time use statistics in America, the thing that's been squeezed out for women is leisure time. So they spend more time with their kids. They spend more time at work, much more time doing both of those activities than they did in the 1970s, and much less time doing things for themselves, like taking walks, playing games, whatever. Then there's the whole Arianna Huffington third metric thing, which I just find really, really funny. The idea that we have to make the infrastructure for relaxation, like we have to hold conferences on how to relax and everything now, really shows us that we have a serious problem, because that's just really not normal, right? Like it used to be people understood that if you want to relax, you just sit on the couch. But now it's like we have to have a TED talk.
But Hannah, I feel so empowered now, because if there's really maybe only one thing that I'm good at, and that's doing nothing. And now you've just given me this like, oh my God, this insight. I could be like a guru of doing nothing. This could be my thing.
You could be a guru. Now here's where you think I'm like doing one of those interview questions where like, I'm a team player. I'm a self-starter. I actually hate about myself that I cannot relax. It's the thing I cannot stand about myself. Like, it's always been true. I've always thought it's because I'm an immigrant, like, because, you know, with immigrants, you always feel like, especially working class immigrants, like, if you don't keep moving forward, you'll just drop into a ditch somewhere. Like, it's just that immigrant mentality that at any moment you could go broke or be fired or have nothing to eat or whatever. But my daughter is kind of the same way. So now that's robbed me of that, you know, bit of historical comfort. So I like Ashley, and it's going to depress Ashley to hear that 13 years into child rearing, I still have this problem. But I'm really thinking hard about it. And sometimes I do things like June said, like I try those things. Like I've tried meditation, which I actually really, really like, but I don't do it that much. I've tried like metal. Like I recently took a metal working class, which was just incredibly fun. Like I made these weird structures and these like fish and bent metal, and you know, I totally loved it. It was really fun. I don't consider TV exactly relaxing. I can't really say why.
That's
it doesn't do the same to me as total relaxation. Like the thing that feels to me like total relaxation is going out with my friends at night.
Yeah.
Like Noreen said. And then actually when David and I, when we like are managed to carve out a space to take like a long urban walk somewhere, that particular category of thing really does it for me. Like either we go away and like into some other city and take a long walk, or like we do it in DC. I find that fabulous and relaxing.
Yeah, walking is the best relaxation ever.
But for the moms, it's like it's a matter of – I wrote this story recently called Off the Clock about how I felt going to Australia. And for the moms, it's really the sense that your baby comes with a clock and you're on the clock. And you're on the clock for the rest of your damn life. And that is true. Like there's always somebody who needs something from you. It's not like you can't shut down your children the way you can shut down your job. Mm-hmm. They're always going to be there. They're always one phone call away. And so you just – so the trick, I think, Ashley, is – actually, what you used to do naturally, like sit on the couch, veg out, have long expanses of time, you actually have to sort of do that more intentionally in whatever ways that work for you. And that way could be like exercise, or it could be, you know, that's not really it for me, even though I exercise, or it could be some other thing, you know, but you just have to be more intentional about getting yourself off the clock for certain parts of the day. So I hope that helps. So here's our final question from Jen.
On a recent episode of Slate's Political Gabfest, Hannah's husband, David Plott, said that he always offers his seat to any woman on a train, and John Dickerson agreed. Emily Bazelon, the lone female on the GabFest, said that she found this gesture gallant and didn't object to it, which I found really surprising. I don't think that I've ever been offered a seat by a man on a train, except when I was visibly pregnant. And if I did, I think as a healthy woman in her mid-30s, I'd find it really strange. So my question for you is, what would you think if this happened to you? Or if it has happened, since apparently men are doing this, what have you thought? If you think that it is acceptable or even desirable for men to give up their seats for women, why do you think that? Thanks.
So can I go first because this involves my husband?
Yeah.
Your friendless husband.
My friendless husband. This is just total crap. It really is complete, absolute crap. Not because David's not gallant, but because he doesn't sit, right? And he doesn't sit on trains or anything. He stands. So he doesn't have the opportunity to offer a woman a seat. But on top of that, the true reason this is crap on the parts of all three of them is it's because they're into the idea of it. But faced with the reality of, say, David – you know, facing a woman exactly his age, he would understand that it's odd and possibly insulting to get up and offer her a seat. Because as a woman, the immediate thing I'm thinking if a man does that to me is like, do I look really old? Or like, Did I hobble my way in there? Like, it's totally different to give up your seat to a much older person or a person who has like, you know, a problem. But just like a woman your age or younger, no way. I mean, it's just weird, right?
Yeah. I have been offered a seat and been so offended. Like, no, seriously. Like, I was like, should I not wear an ampere waist dress? Like, Jesus, like, what's wrong with me today? I do think, okay, so I was very attuned to who sat and who didn't on the subway this morning when I was coming here. And what I realized is that I think if there's an open seat and there's a man and a woman there, doesn't matter the ages, if the man like sort of cuts in front of the woman and takes it, I judge him a little bit.
Me too,
I think in that circumstance, in whatever, you know, baked in notions of gallantry I have come out, and I just think he should give the woman the seat. However, you should never get up and give the woman the seat unless, you know.
That's the fine distinction. That's exactly right. Yeah. Like, you should hand it over to a woman if the two of you are standing next to each other, but not, like, get up and be like, lady, would you like this
seat? So offensive. Okay, the nicest thing that happened to me on the subway years ago, I was wearing shoes that I just should not have been wearing. They were, you know, I was, like, having a night out. And this woman could see that they were just not comfortable shoes. Like, she was, like, a middle-aged woman or something. And she was like, you should sit. Like, aww. No, really. Like, you should sit. I've been
that's
there.
That's awesome.
And I was like, okay. Like, that's so nice of you.
Awesome. That's fabulous. Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Thank you all callers for calling. That was fabulous. I will remind you again that we have a live show coming up on Valentine's Day for all our DC friends. And now, June, why don't you go first with your Christmas time recommendations?
I don't know how Christmassy they are.
Oh, by the way, June, before you begin, can I just say I immediately bought those cherry chocolates. And like I was afraid they'd be all out. So like as soon as we got off the podcast, I ordered those cherry chocolates you recommended. And David loved them. Like,
oh,
he's
I'm
always
so
loved
glad.
Cherry. He loved them. So he saves them up and eats like one every night. So thank
quite,
you for that.
Quite. Yeah. That's the way to do them. We haven't opened ours yet, but any day now. My recommendations are... So last week in Slate, Josh Levine published a big piece called The Welfare Queen, which is just, I can't even begin to say what it's about. I mean, yes, it is about the woman who Ronald Reagan sort of used as his scapegoat for the what he sold as the excesses of the welfare system. but it's just an amazing piece of reporting and writing, and it's just a mind-blowing story. So it's by Josh Levine on Slit. It's called The Welfare Queen, and it would make an amazing movie, 59-part TV series, whatever. Just, I highly recommend it. I also want to recommend a piece that was in Noreen's magazine, The New Republic, a different kind of piece. Laura Bennett had a story about Bloomberg View, Mayor Michael Bloomberg's investment in opinion journalism and why it has really not worked. And it was a good story, but I also feel that Laura deserves a lot of credit for daring to write a piece like that. Not because it was particularly shocking, but just that if there's one thing that journalists are reluctant to do, it is to upset the one person in journalism who seems to pay journalists a lot of money. So a lot of kudos to Laura Bennett for writing that piece.
I hope she gets a raise for it.
I'll go next. I am going to recommend another podcast. It's a Roman Mars podcast of The Wild Ones, which is John Mooallem's great new book, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people looking at animals in America. And in episode 91 of 99% Invisible, which is Roman Mars's show, he records a live storytelling that John Mooallem did with this band called Black Prairie. And John tells this amazing stories from his book. It's like a coherent story, starts with turtles on the runway, ends with this guy seducing a whooping crane. It's so beautiful and fabulous, and it's just like my favorite thing I've listened to all year. So I recommend highly episode 91 of 99% Invisible. Okay, Noreen.
I want to recommend a TV show that I'm not entirely sure is a good TV show, but I enjoy it. Have you guys watched Trophy Wife?
Love it.
I think it's very funny, and it's sort of like Modern Family without the weird ethnic stereotypes, and the little kid actor on it is just the
Bert.
Funny Bert. Yes, he's so funny. Yeah, I think everyone on it's a pretty good actor, and it's like well written, and it's sort of a family comedy, and that isn't something that I necessarily always find hilarious, but it's really good and kind of heartwarming.
Yeah, I agree, and it's really a lovely story in a way about modern families.
Mm-hmm.
In that it's so the Trophy Wife. It's a terrible title, but it's a guy's third wife who is trying to incorporate kind of make peace in the family with his two earlier wives, with whom he has children, and so of course they're all part of the family, and if it was just kind of an issue drama, would not necessarily be good. But it's really funny.
Okay. I'm glad that you think it's good. And now I can be proud about recommending it.
I also want to kind of pipe up for Bert, the youngest kid, is so great. But Warren, the oldest son, I think is maybe getting overlooked a little bit. And he also is fantastic. So
good child actors.
Yeah. There's a lot of really good child actors these days.
That all sounds great. So thank you to Laurie McHugh, our GabFest intern. Thank you to Chris Wade for recording this podcast. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who's both the executive producer of all Slate podcasts and who's going to produce this podcast. So thank you, Andy. And for June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.